Shalom, shalom. Okay, first thing I'd like to do, just for fun, this isn't going to be turned in, but I'd like you to take out a sheet of paper and see if you can write down the paradigm for Kathav. In the perfect. Not that you don't worry about the imperfect, just in the perfect. Just see how much you remember or don't remember. Huh? No. No, just use it for your own notes. I just want you to see how much of it you can get and how much of it you can't get, just before we review that part. Can you spell Kathav? There you got the third person masculine singular form there. Three, so. Just see what you can do with it. That's kind of that. John, I'm just going to have him write down from memory the paradigm for Kathav and the perfect.
Sure.
I'm not looking at the book.
Not going to be turned in. I will never know what you got on it.
But you will.
I'll never know what I got.
But sometimes it helps to do the review after you've seen how much you needed. Okay, well, let's just take a look at page 37. Just turn your book to page 37. You can check it. And we'll just take a quick look at these. We're going to come back to them in a little bit when we get that far, but give an idea of what this looked like. Our third person masculine singular was Katav, then third feminine singular is Katava. You can just check there to get your spelling and so forth. Katavta is your second masculine singular. Katavt is your second feminine singular. Katavti is first person common singular. And meaning that there's no distinction, there's no masculine and feminine in first person. Then Katavu is your third person common plural. They wrote. Katavtim, second person plural, masculine. And Kathav 10, second person feminine plural, and Kathavnu, first person common plural, excuse me. So that's the old paradigm. And let's just say it all together slowly, starting with Kathav, and run through the paradigm just to get the pronunciation again. Remember how this went. Kathav, Kathava, Kathavta, Kathavt, Kathavti, Kathavu, Kathavtim, Kathavten, Kathavnu. Okay, well, you might want to review that a little bit. You can kind of see where your strong or weak spots are. I sprung this on you by surprise on purpose, just to cause you to see where the weak areas are, and I think it'll speed up your review. Probably would have sped it up even more if I had graded this. But that wasn't the purpose. Okay, let's turn back to lesson... Yes, Eric?
On the masculine, on the second person singular.
Yes.
That's a lot. Is it common that you see a hey
in
the
five after the last comma? It can happen. Sometimes you'll see it with the modern. I don't think it's real common, but it does happen. In fact, there'll be some notes to that effect. I think there's... Yes, if you look at the next page, page 38, at the top of the page you see number 2 and then number 3. At the very end, the last statement on number 3, it says, the second person masculine singular also appears with a final mater lexionis. So you have kathavta there with the kamate. So you will see that appear. And we've seen with the imperative, too. If you remember when we talked imperative forms, there was a little blurb about sometimes you'll see the imperative form with the kamate on the end for the second person masculine singular. That does happen. I don't know. I really couldn't tell you what the ratio is, you know, how often it happens. You may have seen it in the text that way, though. Is that what you're asking about? Had you seen it that way in one of the texts or something?
I just wrote it down.
Oh, you wrote it down that way?
Yeah.
Okay, well, as it turns out, you happen to be right. It can be that way at times. But more often than not, you're going to see it this way, just with a commas and no hey. But you will sometimes see it with a comma say. You might have been thinking of that imperative form or something from last year or something and put it down that way. Or put it down the way it sounded, you know, and you normally have a hey on the end when you have a comma. Okay, anybody else? Any questions? Okay, going back to lesson 7 then, where we left off, we just gotten to lesson 7 in our review. First section here is predication of existence. Remember these little words, yesh and ein, that were the predication of existence and the denial of existence. And this is kind of a different grammatical structure or setup than we've seen in other languages. So it takes a little getting used to. But in order to state that something exists, Hebrew employs the word yesh, commonly translated there are or there is. And it can be either one because the form of the word doesn't change. That's why it's kind of hard to call it a verb. It's got kind of a verbal function, but it's not inflected like a verb. In other words, you don't have a paradigm to learn for yesh or for ein. They're the same form regardless. And it's kind of because the subject is an indefinite thing. And, you know, there is. I mean, in a technical sense, you might call the there the subject, but what is there, you know? It's kind of a nebulous, indefinite word. So... Yesh ish then would mean there is a man, or yesh isha, there is a woman, or yesh anashim, there are men. There again, yesh does not change its form, whether it's singular, plural, masculine, or feminine. So then he just states that. The negative expression for non-existence is ein. So ein ish or ein isha would mean there is no man or there is no woman. This sentence type figures largely in expressing possession. So here we encounter that idiom for possession in Hebrew, and it's very commonly used. So we have phrases like, Ein la'ish ketzef. The man has no silver. Literally, what would it be in a very literal translation?
There's not to the man silver.
Yes, there is not to the man silver. There is not to the man silver. So that's the way they're looking at it. There's not to be attributed to the man silver. In other words, he has no silver. And that's the way they're thinking of it. And yesh ish laisha, there is a husband to the woman, or the woman has a husband. So this is their way to express possession. Then it says in preceding lessons we dealt with sentences having an adverbial predicate. All of the examples used both in lesson and exercises had definite nouns as subjects. When one constructs a similar sentence with an indefinite subject, such as a man is in the house, we find that this is virtually equivalent to the existential sentence, there is a man in the house. To say a man is in the house is basically the same, at least as far as Hebrew is concerned, as saying there is a man in the house. And so what they will customarily do in situations like that is rather than saying using an indefinite noun and using yesh as a predicate, and using an adverbial predicate, they will use yesh or ein and use the indefinite form of the noun. So thus the sentences expressing existence and those having adverbial predicates are sometimes identical. So we find, first of all, the example from before, ha'ish babayat, the man is in the house. That was our normal adverbial predicate sentence structure that we learned earlier. Now, if you want to say a man is in the house, they will customarily say it this way, yesh ish babayat, there is a man in the house. And ein ish babayat, there is no man in the house, there is not a man in the house. So if you want to say a man, you see, and you're kind of talking in a general sense about the existence of something in a certain state, then you'll use this existential type of construction. Okay. Any questions about that? That's more of an idiomatic thing than anything else. And I don't know if we can say Ish Babayeth, a man is in the house, may be a possibility, but it's probably just not likely to be seen. That's the main reason for talking about this yesh and ein in this sense. Okay, then the prepositions, b'le and eth with pronominal suffixes. We're going to save k for later on because it does some funny things with the pronominal suffixes, as you recall, getting a name in there and things. So b'le, and then we'll add eth to this. Remember that this is our first encounter with pronominal suffixes, and it was by no means the last. We became very good friends with these, or at least very familiar with these, for quite some time. And here's the first example. So what we're doing is putting a pronominal suffix on the preposition to indicate the pronoun here. And so li, for example, is just taking the preposition lama, then adding the pronominal suffix for first person singular to that, and we get to me. So the idea of le is to, and then of course the hirikyoth is me, to me. Laka, to you, masculine singular. Lak, to you, feminine singular. Lo, to him. La, to her. Lanu, to us. Lahem, to you, masculine plural. Lahen, to you, feminine plural. Lahem, to them, masculine plural. And lahen, to them, feminine plural. So these are endings that we need to really make ours, and they're ones that are easy to recognize. The system is pretty consistent as far as recognition throughout many of these paradigms, so that helps you a lot when it comes to translating. When we go through the text and we're translating passages of Hebrew scripture, you're going to find that you will be picking up, even in complicated verb forms where we've got all kinds of strange things, you may not know what the verb root is, but you can tell whether it's first person, second person, third person, or whether it's singular or plural. You'll be able to pick up that information just from the suffix. But you can see that something grotesque has happened to the verb form, you know, and so you may not recognize what it originally came from, and that's where these complications arise. So, but as far as reading through, you're not really having to think of paradigms, I suppose, after a while. You get so associated with the meanings that there's no problem there. That's never been a real big problem. All right. So there's several things to note here. Here, as elsewhere in the language, a distinction is made. Distinction between genders is made in the second person as well as in the third. There are thus four Hebrew pronouns corresponding to English you. So we have four possibilities for you. We've got the singulars, masculine and plural. The singulars, masculine and feminine, and the plurals, masculine and feminine. Preposition b with the suffix is exactly like the above. Although with b you have an alternate form bam and for bahim. And instead of saying by him, they'll just say bomb very often. In fact, I think even more commonly than by him. So you just need to be aware of that. Not so much with bond with a feminine, because you don't say things, you don't talk about feminines very often. It's, if it's men, it's masculine, and if it's a mixed group, it's masculine. So you don't very seldom are you talking about a group of women in the scriptures, and so those forms are relatively rare. And so when you have a rare form, there's no point in making a contraction or something for it, because it's just not used that often anyway. All right, then we have the pronouns in the stuck onto S, the pronominal, object marker. And so if you want to use a pronoun as a direct object of a sentence, this is the way it'll be done. You'll take F and put the suffix on it with a few changes. In fact, the vowel changes from the segol to a colon on the F, and then you add the suffix. So you have othi, othaka, othak, otho, otha, etc. Excuse me. Okay, so the endings are no different than what you see above. It's just that you're putting on a slightly different vowel point on the F, and then it does change with F chem and F hen. Instead of oath, it goes back to the segol again. So you have to watch for that one. Then otham and otham. Slightly different endings than you had above for lahim and lahin, but not a huge problem, I don't think. There are some alternate forms. You can have F hem and F hen. Those forms do also occur, but far less frequently. Any questions on these paradigms, other than just having to memorize them again or remind yourself of them? There's really nothing technical about it. It's just a matter of learning the endings. Now, examples of usage here, some sentence structures. Ha'ish nothein lanu lechem. The man is giving to us bread. So here you see an example of the prepositional phrase to being used with the suffix. So it's to us, just using lamed with the suffix, lanu. And then, ein li kesef, I have no silver. That's that idiom again. But there's not to me silver. So you have li there, to me. You're kind of an indirect object in this sense, in a certain sense of the word. That's their idiom for expressing possession. Yesh lahim melech, they have a king. There is to them a king. There lahim, again, using the preposition with a pronominal suffix. And hamelech sholeach otham es ha'ir. The king is sending them to the city. Again, using a participle for your verb. And then otham would be your direct object with the pronominal suffix, masculine plural, a third person. So he's sending them, a group of men somehow, to the city. Okay, any questions on any of that information? Let's review and so forth. So this is pretty straightforward. The plot thickens, of course, as we move chapter after chapter. Okay, demonstrative adjectives and pronouns in lesson 8. We have demonstratives are things that point to this or that. They're kind of pointers. They're kind of calling a person's attention to a particular thing. And we have distinction between in proximity here. This is something very close, and that is something further away. And but both of them are being pointed out. And so we find for this, the word this, in the singular we have zeh for masculine and zoth for feminine, and the plural is common. We have ele. Ele is used for either masculine or feminine, meaning pointing to this or these, actually. And then for the that we have who and he, who for the masculine, he for the feminine, and then him and hena for those in the plural, masculine and feminine. And those words him and hena are irregular. They don't point it out here, but they do take an irregular article. They take a he with full comments for the article, which is unusual. It doesn't fit the normal rule for putting the article on. You get a compensatory lengthening here instead of virtual doubling. Okay, then these words have usage parallel to that of the adjective. So in effect, they're adjectives. Syntactically, they're adjectives, and they function just like adjectives. So we see examples here: ha'ish hazeh, this man, or ha'isha hazoth, this woman, or ha'anashim ha'ela, these men, or ha'anashim ha'ela, these women, ha'ish ha'hu, that man, ha'ish ha'hi, that woman, ha'isha ha'hi, excuse me, Ha'anashim Ha'him, those men, and Ha'anashim Ha'hina, those women. You can see the article on Haim and Hina there being irregular there. You've got a full comment on the Hay. The demonstrative stands last in a series of adjectives. So your normal pattern is to have your adjective, and attributive adjective is always going to follow the noun. And if you've got a number of adjectives on it already, the demonstrative will stand last. So that's their pattern, to put the demonstrative last in the series of adjectives. And then the form without the article has the status of a pronoun. So, and this is compare the use of the predicate adjective. So just like we saw with the predicate adjective, if you take the article off the adjective and place it in apposition to a noun that's got the article, you get a predication. So Aish told, for example, was the man is good. Same kind of thing can happen with the demonstrative. And you can have Zeh Aish, for example, putting out in front now, but still no article on Zeh. And it constitutes, again, a predication. This is the man. This is the man. And so it becomes almost like a pronoun in predication to a noun. And so this is the man. Or Zot Ha'isha, this is the woman. Ela Ha'divarim, these are the words. Then again, note that agreement in number and gender is present as with the adjective. So as any other adjective, there's agreement there, concord. Okay, nothing really... really intrinsically knew about that. I thought the only thing you need to remember is that the demonstrative comes last in a series of adjectives, but its other functions are syntactically just like any other adjective, for that matter. Then participles, a little more information. Here we get a three hey verb, and see what happens to it in the participle forms. And what happens to it is it's bonat. You get a segol hey on the end, rather than the OA form, the cholam seri form that you're used to. It's cholam segol there, and then the feminine is bona, and the plurals bonim and bonoth. There is an alternate form for the feminine, bonia. You get a hirik yod there, which seems strange. Where does that come from? But after you've looked later on at the perfect of three hey verb, you'll find that that hirik yod creeps in a number of the forms there too as part of the stem. So that he makes some mention of that here. The final hey of the form, bonet, is a mater lectionis for the final vowel and not a third root consonant. That's why it's acting as though it's only got two consonants, because in effect it does. The hey is only a mater. And the root in this class of verbs must be considered as variable in form, sometimes bn or beth nun, sometimes beth nun yoth. And so we find the remnant of that in this alternate form for the feminine, bonia. You get that yod in there. You'll see that even more frequently in the actual full paradigm in the perfect, where you get that hirik yod in quite frequently. Okay, so that's just a matter of memorization. I guess there's nothing more that can be said about that. You notice the whole in this common all the way through, but then the rest of it is a little bit different. Okay, so that was a short lesson. Then we get to lesson 9, the perfect of katav. So we've already done that as a slight exercise, a little exercise here. But there's several observations that are made about the verb in Hebrew. There are two full verbal inflections for person, number, and gender for each Hebrew verb. The first is called the perfect. The first is formed by adding subject suffixes to a relatively fixed stem, as illustrated by kathav and kathavti. Kathav he wrote and kathavti I wrote. The second, called the imperfect, uses a different stem and has person, number, and gender marked by both prefixes and suffixes. So the imperfect is a little bit more difficult in that we have prefixes to worry about as well as suffixes. So you had yiktov and tiktovna and so forth, where you have prefix in the first case only, and then a prefix and a suffix in the second example. We shall begin to study the verb with a perfect full inflection, which is as follows. So we have our full paradigm for kathav again. Kathav, kathava, kathavta, kathavt. Kathavti, kathavu, kathavtem, kathavten, and kathavnu. And again, just to double emphasize, make sure that you're memorizing what the thing means along with the word, so you just don't have a paradigm that you can regurgitate out on a piece of paper, you know, and not have any understanding of what it means. And remember that he makes a number of notes here. I guess I'll just go through these quickly. The following particulars should be noted. Number one, the traditional arrangement of a verbal paradigm in Hebrew begins with the third person and proceeds to the first. Now, that's just the opposite of the Greek. For the Greek students, we start out with the first person and work to the third. In Hebrew, it starts with the third person and works to the first. Does anybody have a reason why that might be the case?
you know, a philosophical reason or something. Why?
Yeah, go ahead.
Simplest.
Yeah, it's the simplest. You're starting with the simplest form. In Greek, the simplest form is just with the omega ending and the omega conjugation. That's the simplest ending that you'll have on the verb, and that's the dictionary form that they use, and that's where you look up the verb under. In Hebrew, the shortest form is your third person masculine singular form. It has no ending on it at all, and that's the dictionary form, and so that's the appropriate place to start. So that's basically it. It's just a matter of simplicity and trying to start with the simplest one and put the more complicated ones to follow. So that's the reason for it. But don't forget that that's the case, otherwise you can get a lot of confusion between the languages. And I suppose it's just as well that they reverse it, because you see, in Hebrew you also have gender to worry about where you don't have in Greek. The Greek doesn't make any distinction in the verb forms between the gender, the noun. But Hebrew does in many cases. In the perfect it does. In the singulars, in the third person and second person, you have a form for the masculine, a form for the feminine. Same thing with second person. In the first person, it's common. And in the plurals, you have a separate form in the second person for the masculine and the feminine. And in the imperfect, you get it for the third person and second person. So the imperfects have one extra form. You know, they probably notice the paradigm's a little longer in the imperfect. That's because they make a distinction in the third person also. But in the first person, both in the perfect and the imperfect, it's just one form. No distinction ever made between gender and the first person. So a traditional arrangement of a verbal paradigm in Hebrew begins with the third person, proceeds to the first. Second point, in the perfect there's a distinction of form for gender in the second, third persons, I just mentioned that, and in the second person, plural. The others, including the first person singular and plural and the third person plural, do not reflect the gender of the subject. Third point, the endings given in the paradigm above are standard for nearly all the verbs in the language. So that's pretty true. The ending systems are consistent for about all the verbs in the entire language, all the irregular ones included. The ending systems are pretty straightforward. It's the stems that change. And so many variations will be seen to occur in the stems of various types of verb types, but the endings themselves remain fairly constant. Then he makes note here of the fact that you'll see the second person masculine singular sometimes with a mater on it. And so it'll be pronounced the same, kathavta. But you'll see the hay on the end, so don't be surprised if you see that in the text sometime. Then the fourth point here, the stem of the verb kathav changes in accordance with the shape of the suffix added. I don't know, again, if this is what, I'm not going to take time to go through this right now, because it may be faster for you just to memorize the paradigm and not worry about the reasons why this is that. It depends on the way you think and what's easier for you, so kind of leave it up to you, but... sometimes you can get bogged down with trying to figure out, you know, this syllable closed or open, stressed or unstressed, and so forth. Try to figure out what it is and predict it in every case, and then by that time you've forgotten the paradigm, you know. So it's kind of a matter of judgment as to what's worth what here. The fifth point, though, just make a note of this. When the final root consonant is the same as that which begins the suffix, only one letter is written. In other words, some of these suffixes start with consonants, tau being one, tau and nun being the two that were primary ones we're worried about. So if the verb happens to end in a tau or a nun, then you will see, rather than writing two nuns in a row and two taus in a row, when you put the suffix on, they'll just write one and put a dagesh forte in there. And you may not even notice this. I mean, the sound is going to be the same. For example, for karat, ending in a tau, if you want to say, I cut, then it would be karati, karati, and you'd use a tau, a single tau, rather than putting two of them in a row. See, if with kathav, it was kathavti, you had the base and the tau. Here you would have had karati with two taus in a row if you followed the normal paradigm, the normal pattern. But since you get two taus in a row, they've got a way to do that with doubling. So they just write one tau down and put a dagesh in it. With nun in shakan, ending with nun, you have a suffix for the first person plural, shakanu, And instead of writing two nuns down there, they just write one down and put the Dalgetian. It's just logic. It's just simple logic that they would do it that way. So it's just, but the thing that trips you up sometimes is when your eye first looked at it, it looks too short. And the tendency may be to be guessing that maybe it's an imperative or something like that, because it's short. You have to realize that what has happened there. So that's probably the kind of mistakes that are going to be commonly made in things like that. Okay. He mentions here the fact that there will be lots more verbs that will have peculiarities. And so we'll be getting into those in plenty of, in due time anyway. The meaning of the perfect, basically the perfect is completed action. Action's already been completed, so your translations are generally going to be past tense or present perfect. Present perfect is where you have a present result of a previous action. You know, I have done this or something like that, where you're now living with the result of an action that took place in the past. The Hebrew is not making a lot of refinement as far as the tense idea is concerned. Basically, completed action versus incompleted action for the perfect and the imperfect. But then there are some, you know, they rely on context to set the rest of the details. And so he mentions here some of the other possible translations of the perfect because of contextual considerations and the meaning of the verb itself. So first point here is that it's almost always just translated in the English simple past or in the present perfect. So either I wrote or I have written. Secondly, with verbs signifying perception or the attitude or disposition of the subject toward an object rather than direct action. So if it's not an active verb, it's not a verb of action, but it's a verb of perception or attitude or something like that, in that case, the perfect may be translated by the general present tense. So ahavti, for example, would be I love. Even though it's perfect in form, it's because it's an attitude or perception and so forth. You're kind of describing the state of your heart towards someone, etc. And that should not be just something that was that way in the past, but is not anymore. It's something that, you know, continues. And so it depends on the context with this, though. You kind of have to watch the context. In some cases, it may be I loved past tense. In other contexts, it may be I love present tense in English. Or yadati, I know. There's something again. Knowing involves having information logged in the brain, and if you knew something at one time, the probability is you know it now as well. And the idea is, if you know something, it's because information has come to you at some time in the past, and it's now being registered in your brain and so forth. Now you have that experience, and so you know it. So there's some, you know, having to do with the meaning of the word that will affect the translation of it. I would be careful about just translating it, I know, present tense all the time, wherever you see it. Look at the context, but consider that as an option as well. Then with verbs signifying the mental or physical state of the object, what we often term stative verbs, and we'll deal with those in this section a little bit later on, and which consequently do not occur with a direct object. They're intransitive, of course. The perfect may be translated by the English present of the verb to be plus an adjective. So oftentimes they'll just use an adjective type of translation in English. So zakanti, for example, I am old, or I have become old, or I grew old. Again, context is going to have to be your guide in the exact translation of it. But it's describing a state that you've arrived at, and rather than some action that was performed. And then one little final comment. Rarely in prose, but rather frequently in poetry and proverbial expressions, the perfect is used to denote habitual activity with no specific tense value. Such uses are translated by the English general present, I write. Again, we have to make judgments as far as context, tenor, and all that to decide these things, and these are observations that have been made when that kind of thing has been done. It's not a blanket thing where wherever it's in poetry or something, you do it that way. It's just that it's commonly used that way in poetry. And poetry oftentimes takes license and liberty with language anyway. Okay, so basically then, perfect is going to be translated past tense, and the imperfect will be translating either present tense or future when the time comes. Okay, then section 45, word order in the verbal sentence. He wants to talk about your basic normal verb word order in Hebrew, although word order is not rigidly held. I mean, there's not a lot of rigid rules for word order in Hebrew. There are some basic patterns that normally occur, and then deviations from those patterns will be used to express emphasis. So the normal word order pattern in Hebrew is the verb first, then the subject, then the object, and then various adverbial elements that are tacked on. So verb, subject, object, and various adverbial elements. That's your normal word order.
And here's a couple of examples. Zakar ha'ish et ha'devarim. The man remembered the words. Zakar, verb first, ha'ish, subject, and then et ha'devarim, your direct object. Katav ha'ish et ha'devar ba'sefer. The man wrote the word in the book. Katav, your verb, ha'ish, the subject follows, then your direct object, et ha'devar, and then an adverbial modifier, ba'sefer, in the book. Now, it is by no means unusual to find the subject or some other element before the verb, but such sentence order is often conditioned by interclause relationships taken up below, and he means quite a ways below. I mean, further back in the book, we haven't even got to some of this stuff yet. Or by emphasis on the element which is placed first. So you can put the, if you want to put emphasis on a certain word, you can place it first, and that will give you automatic emphasis in Hebrew. The verb agrees in person, number, and gender with its subject. Pronominal suffixes are inherent in the verb form itself. So the idea of he or she or it or whatever doing it, you don't need to put a separate pronoun there. You can do that and get more emphasis, but you don't need it. The verb contains that information in the ending. So Zakar et ha'devarim, he remembered the words. Zakara et ha'devarim, she remembered the words. That information as far as he or she is contained right in the verb form. So you don't need a word for he or she separate from that. Okay, then the particle F is used before definite objects, as previously explained. So we've already seen that, but again, reiterating that, F is used whenever you're denoting a direct object that's definite, either by virtue of its being a proper name or by virtue of its having the article. The perfect is negated with lo. So that's the way you negate the verb. If you want to say something was not done, then you put lo in front of it. And so we have lo zakarti et ha'davar. I did not remember the word. And of course the lo will precede the verb, comes in front of the verb. I guess the idea is they want to make sure it's negated before you even get the verb there. Yes? Oh, yes. Yes, there sometimes is some... you know, normally there's a difference. You know, the low over there is just with a full wow, and this is with an Allah. But apparently there are instances of where there's a crossover there, and so you have to be kind of careful for it and watch for it. You can usually tell because the position will be different. In other words, the low for a negative is going to be before a verb, and if it's not before a verb, there's got to be something else. And I suppose there's debates in some of those things. Some claim there's a, you know, manuscript error or something that's a result of that. But that's a minor point to be aware of, and we'll probably see as we go in the text. Okay, then there's another little note as far as word order is concerned that we should draw attention to again. The indirect object always marked by the preposition le. So if you want an indirect object, something was done to or for someone, you'll always mark it with le, the preposition lama. That's the way they mark their indirect object. It tends to precede the direct object when the former is pronominal and the latter nominal. Okay, what does that mean? Pronominal means that it's a pronoun. Nominal means it's actually a word, a real live word, you know, that's like any other word. So if a pronoun is representing some word and the nominal, the noun itself, is the actual noun. So if you have a situation where your indirect object is pronominal, that is, it's a pronoun, to him, to her, to it, to, you know, that type of thing, where you're not specifically stating what that thing is, and your direct object is nominal, where it's actually stated, then the tendency is going to be to have the pronominal indirect object before the direct object. So Nathan lo et ha'isha, he gave him the woman. He gave to him the woman. Him is the indirect object there. It's pronominal. But the woman is a nominal direct object. So your general order there is going to be nathan, lo. You're going to have the indirect object first. Otherwise, if it's not that situation where the indirect object is pronominal, the normal order is indirect object is going to follow the direct object. In other words, you'll have verb, subject, direct object, indirect object in that order. So here's some examples there. Nathan, otha, lo, Ha'isha. Here you have both of them pronominal now. The direct object is pronominal and the indirect object is pronominal. And since they're both pronominal, the direct object is going to precede the indirect object. So he gave her to him. He gave her is the direct object. It's the thing that's being given, and then to him follows that. Or if they're both nominal, like in the next example, Nathan et Ha'isha La'ish, he gave the woman to the man. There we have two nominal items there, one of them direct object, one of them indirect object, and the direct object comes first, then the indirect object. So that's your normal order, direct object, indirect object. But if the indirect object is pronominal and the direct object is nominal, then it will tend to come first. So you can kind of think of it, if the indirect object is shorter, and it's the shortened form, you know, the pronoun, it's going to come first. Otherwise, if they're the same, or if the indirect object is pronominal, and if nominal and the other one's pronominal, the direct object will come first. Does that all make sense? Or at least can you follow that? Okay. And that, again, is only the general tendency. That doesn't mean that this is an ironclad rule that cannot be broken. It's just the way things normally appear. And for reasons of emphasis or something, you might see a deviation from that. Then we look at the forms of the conjunction w. The same kinds of things happen to this in a way as happened with other words that we have stuck onto the front of words. And so, like the prepositions b, l, and could, the conjunction w and differs in form before various word beginnings. And we break this down into four categories. First, before a labial consonant, b, p, or a m, you know, base, pay, or main, where in all of those sounds, you're putting your lips together. That's why they give it a labial sound. The sounds that are labial, where you're putting your lips together to make the sound, b, p, or m, the form is going to be oo. So instead of w, it's going to be oo before those three letters. So bayeth, for example, is going to be uvayeth. Po is going to be ufo. Of course, they soften when you get a vowel sound in front of them, too. Mayim is going to be umayim. So for those three consonants, if they begin a word, the form is always going to be u rather than w. Then b, before a word beginning with yod shwa, we have the conjunction in the first syllable of the word contract to we. And you know, this is not unlike things we've seen before with things that begin with shwa. So if something begins with yod shwa, the yod is going to become a part of a mater, and you're going to get we on the front. And so Yehuda, for example, becomes we Huda and Judah. And yidatem, you knew, becomes we datem and you knew. Okay, then before a word beginning with any consonant except yod plus shwa, the form is u. So we go back to that u form if anything has a shwa on the first syllable. So Shemuel, for example, becomes Ushemuel. So keep that one in mind. And then before a guttural plus chatef pasach, chatef segol, or chatef kamatz, the conjunction is respectively the wal with the kamatz, wal with segol, or wal with kamatz chatuf. In other words, it's rule of shawa here, basically. If you start with a guttural that's got a reduced vowel, which is the equivalent of shawa, and you put something else on the front of that thing, it gets the full vowel corresponding to the short vowel. So it's just a kind of another species of the rule of shawa that we've already learned. So aratzov, for example, becomes wa aratzov, and edom becomes we edom, and oni becomes wo oni. Okay, so full vowel corresponding to short vowel. So that's a good review of those rules for the putting the w on the front of the word. Otherwise, it's just w. I guess they don't even mention the normal pattern. It's just sticking w on the front. If it's not any one of these peculiarities, it's just putting the wa with shwa in the front of the word. Okay, questions on any of that? Lesson 10: the perfect of verbs with guttural root consonants. So here's the beginning of our irregular verbs, and none of these are too nasty. There's three types here, putting a guttural in various positions. And so if we have a guttural in the first position, then the problem that you run into, the only real problem you run into, is in your second person plural forms, where you had that heavy ending, they call it, that drew the accent, and you had a shwa on the first syllable. Since the guttural can't take shwa, that just has to change to a katef fatak. That's the only problem with those verbs. So amaz is just like katav, except for the fact that you got amaz tem and amaz ten with the katef fatak on the front. Other than that, the paradigm's identical. Then if you have your guttural in the second position, the only real problems occur when the second position would have had a shwa on it. And there are a couple forms in the paradigm where that would have occurred, and you can see those in the third person feminine singular and the third person plural form. So we've got Bachara instead of Bachara or something like that. Bachara. And then Bacharu. Instead of Bacharu, it's Bacharu. You've got the Katas Pasak on those two forms. So all you really need to remember about those is if you want to put a Shua on it, it's a guttural, you can't. You just put Katas Pasak, and that'll really take care of it. Then if your guttural is in the third position, about the only real, well, I guess there's nothing really problematical with it, except that in those second person masculine and feminine plural forms down there again, you do see, and I guess in several of the other forms, which ones do we have? Second person masculine singular, first person singular, and so forth, where you get a shwa on the last syllable to close the syllable, they'll go ahead and put a shwa on this thing even though it's a guttural. And that would normally seem to break the rule, but it isn't a vocal shwa. It's not a shwa that's getting vocalized. It's only showing a closed syllable. And so for that reason, they went ahead and put it on by convention on these verb forms. So you'll go ahead and do that. And then, in addition, in the second person feminine singular form, notice the shama'at there, or shama'at. That's kind of an anomalous form he mentions up here at the top of page 44. And it says the only form in the paradigm of shama, the three guttural, that requires comment is shama'at, which as it stands is anomalous. It is likely that such spellings were meant by the punctuators to show an option. We should either read shama'at with a soft sound at the end, ignoring the dagesh, or shama'at, or just shamat, almost, ignoring the second pasak. So you have your choice as to how to pronounce it, I guess. And it's a bit confusing. Different textbooks deal with this differently, too. You kind of adopt a convention and go from there. So I'm not really too worried about which way you pronounce that. But that's the way the form looks. That's the way the Masoretes put the vowel points on it and so forth. So that's what we've got to work with. But other than that, there's really nothing peculiar about this whole these three classes. Your one guttural, two guttural, three guttural verbs. Slight differences, but nothing really drastic. Now, then the perfect amnasan demands a certain amount of attention. It's just an irregular. Now, it's just to look at it. It looks like a normal strong verb, a normal three consonantal verb. Everything looks okay because you've got three nice looking consonants on there. However, the second nun of the stem is always assimilated to the initial consonant of the subject suffixes. Note carefully the following forms. So you expect it in the case of the suffix begins with nun. You expect a certain assimilation. But the strange thing is that here, the nun actually gets assimilated into the tau, and it goes away as it were. It only shows up as a dagesh in the tau. So look at the paradigm. You see what I mean. You got nathan, that's fine, and nathana, that's fine. But then we've got nathata. Instead of nathanta, like you might have expected, the nun gets assimilated into the tau, and we have nathata. And then nathat, same thing happens there. Nathati, same thing happens there. Nathanu, same thing happens there, in fact, although we don't have a dagesh to show for it. And nathatim, nathatin, and nathanu, there you get the dagesh showing up there. We see that doubling taking place and that assimilation in most all of those forms. So that's the unusual thing about Nathan. And again, what happens is the verb looks too short. Many of these forms look too short that way. And it can sometimes generate some confusion between a strong form of a certain, verb that has one of these irregularities and another verb that was weak in a certain place and something else dropped out of the middle or something. And so you get those problems from time to time. And you may do a few wild goose chases looking a word up if you haven't seen it before, trying to figure out what kind it is. Yes?
Uh-huh. What are they called? Those were just two letter
apart. Oh, yes. Yes. Well, we had geminate verbs that did some funny things there, and then we just had the two consonant verbs, like bomb and ba and com, for example, and they did some things. Yeah, and then when we got to infinitives and infinitive constructs and so forth, we had a lot of those forms, and imperatives also. imperatives that had similar suffixes, but something got lopped off the word. So that's the kind of thing that, you know, that's where the difficulties arise, is just trying to figure out what the root was. And, of course, sometimes you, even after you've known all these things, you'll still resort to the analytical or something to resolve some of these conflicts, because you may never have seen a verb before, and maybe one of these are highly irregular ones. Most of the time, of course, you won't have to consult one, but sometimes you may. Okay, then we have noun plurals. Got a few minutes left here. Noun plurals. A few more notes on these. First of all, we have a certain category, disyllabic nouns, having two syllables, with the sequence aye, show a regular contraction in the plural stem. So there's a number of words that have this aye type of morpheme there, if you want to call it that, or a pattern of vowels, and they will always come out the same in the plural. So you have zayith, for example, meaning olive tree, or almost always come out the same in the plural. There's an exception, as you'll see here, but zayith becomes zaytim. You get a tseri yod in the first syllable, and then just your em ending. So, and ayil, same thing, aylim. So the same pattern occurs there. Then the word bayit, house, is irregular, becomes batim. And that's one of the few places, if not the only place of any importance in the language, where you have a comet in a closed, unaccented syllable. So that's why the metag is there, to show that the comet is strange in that position. To have a closed syllable, have an unaccented, and have a comet in it is unusual indeed. Okay, then section B, there are many nouns of two syllables whose singular and plural stems are identical. These include nouns both of whose syllables are not susceptible to the changes represented in the preceding sections dealing with the noun. So these basically involve a closed syllable with a short vowel or an unchangeable long vowel. And if those conditions prevail in both syllables, then you're not going to see any shortening occurring at all. So evyon, for example, evyonim. Gibor, giborim. Tzadik, tzadikim. Amuz, amuzim. In all of those cases, you either have generally the first syllable is short vowel that can't shorten anyway, it's closed syllable, and the second syllable has an unchangeable long. So in those circumstances, you're not going to be able to do any pretonic or propretonic reduction, so the stem for the plural is just the same. All you do is add your em ending or oath ending, whichever is appropriate. Then the C, a small group of nouns ends in e in the singular. Although this is not a suffix but an integral part of the root word, it does not occur on the plural stem. So we have sadeh, for example, one of the common vocab words that we had, and the plural is sadot. So the f, the hey, just drops off completely, and you just drop off the segol hey, basically, and then add oath, and that's it. Machaneh, same thing, becomes machanoth. So nouns originally participles of verbs three hey, that is, whose third consonant is given as hey, also belong to this class. So ro'eh becomes ro'im, same kind of situation there. And that's probably where, most possibly where some of these other nouns came from in the first place, according to some speculation anyway. All right, any problems, difficulties, questions about those chapters? Most of it's just refinement and fine detail. Okay, lesson 11 is the perfect of verbs 3 aleph. And the peculiarity here has to do with the aleph quiescing and causing a lengthening of the vowel on the second syllable. And so instead of pafak there, we get comets there, and the aleph itself quiesces. So we've got matzah with two comets there, matzah, matzatha, matzath. What else has happened to the suffix on some of these forms? Yeah, you have the soft instead of the hard. So instead of matzata, it's matzatha. And the reason is that you've got a long vowel sound coming before the begad kafat, and that's actually a dagesh lene rather than a forte, so it drops out and it gets a soft sound before a vowel. Most of the time you had a closed syllable there, you see, and then it closed with a consonant, and then you started a new syllable with the suffix, and therefore you got your hard sound. But now you're getting a soft sound because of the quiescence of the aleph. Well, we'll look at that again tomorrow and continue from there. Some of these chapters are going to go a little faster now because you almost always have another peculiarity with a verb, so we just keep learning more peculiarities. We'll slow down on the areas where new grammar is introduced, so we make sure get all the pieces back together and then proceed. Okay, is there a roll sheet around? Did I get it back yet? Oh, okay. Okay, you made that up?
Yes.
All right, got it. Thanks, Peter.
Yeah, sure.
Right.